Well, good morning, everyone. We're very glad you're here, especially if you're visiting with us. We're happy that you're here. And if you hear anything that sounds a little odd or something you're not familiar with or have some questions, please feel free to ask. Just about anyone of our regular members can help you with those things. We sang about unity just now. Brady, as the song leaders are good to do, all the song leaders are good to do, they asked me what I'm going to preach on, and so I try to give them some ideas. Sometimes my thoughts are a little more nebulous than I would like when they ask me, and sometimes I don't have a particular song or a particular, even a theme that's really kind of clear in my head when they ask me. I'm not preaching on unity per se this morning, but then again I am. I'm going to take it from a little different angle. I want to talk about our attitude. Now, this started from a study of Job. I'm going to kind of dive into the book of Job a little bit. And I was going to do this sermon called something like Questions for Which There Are No Answers, something like that. And I might do that in the future. But I got a little bit hung up on what Job was going through and how he dealt with that. And then I got thinking, I'm not sure. I think we try to deal with things much differently than Job does. And so I kind of figured that's kind of the way we try to deal with things. And that really is me. I mean, I try very hard not to show my feelings most of the time. I was kind of raised that way. I think a lot of us were. Sometimes it's necessary. I do memorial services sometimes. And I do those for people who are very close to me. I spoke at my mother's memorial service, for example, and many others like that. And people will ask me, well, how do you do that? And I say, I don't know. Somehow I get into this zone where I can hold my feelings in, and I'm pretty good at that. I'm a little bit too good at that, I think. And that's kind of what I'm going to talk about. I will say that as I've gotten older, I find it a little bit easier to get more sentimental. And that kind of, I think, is a result of aging, not a bad one. I mean, now I listen to songs and I find that tears come to my eyes a little more often than they used to. I wouldn't even ever admit, probably 20 years ago, that I ever kind of wept at a song or even had tears come to my eyes. So that's my point. It's okay to cry. I think that's kind of a weird title. I've struggled with this a little bit. And it probably says something about me that I struggle with this title. It's okay to cry. It just, I don't know. It sounds kind of gushy or something. But in John 11:35, you know that Jesus wept, right? We all know that. That's a passage we're all familiar with, if only because it's short. And sometimes we kind of ignore that. But the fact is, Jesus did weep. It wasn't the only time that he wept. He did weep. On many occasions in the Bible, we see weeping and crying. And not only weeping, I'm not just talking this morning about the act of crying or the act of weeping. I'm talking about expressing ourselves honestly to each other. And that's where the unity part comes in, and we'll get to that in a bit. For boys who were raised in my era, it wasn't cool to cry, and it was something that we were encouraged not to do. And that was kind of the culture of the day. Nobody wanted to be a crybaby, that's for sure. That was about the worst thing you could call somebody back then. My mother would hold it in. My mother was an emotional person, but she too was a child of the, well, she was a child of the 20s, but as we think about the 50s and all that, she was good to kind of hold her emotions in, not express them too much. In fact, as I think back on it, I can only think of two occasions where I heard my mother cry. And one of them was when she was telling me about a 9-year-old boy who attended with us in Kalinga, California, in the church there, who was killed in an auto accident. I was staying with my grandmother, and I was about 12, he was 9, and she came and told me she broke down and cried. That was the only time. Another time, I don't know what was going on. I think she had an argument with Dad or something. But the only two times, and my mom was, as I found out much later, was a very emotional person. I think it was just the way that we were taught, the culture we lived in, that you just didn't show your emotions very much. And that's a very American thing to do. It seems to me, and there are others in this room know a lot more about this than I do, but I think it's just kind of the way we've been and the way we've kind of grown up in America, when you see some terrible tragedy, often you see the muffled cries and everybody trying to kind of hold that in. And sometimes when you look at other nations where that happens, when you see things happen in other nations, you see the people actually wailing and crying loudly and screaming almost. And you just kind of takes you back. It's because it's so expressionful. That's a word. They're so full of expression. Where here we're very, very drawn in. My question is this morning, does the Bible encourage keeping the old stiff upper lip? Because what we do is we praise the stiff upper lip. We have, at least in my lifetime, most of the time. We say, somebody says, well, how's she doing? And you say, she's doing well. What does that mean? What do we mean by that? Somebody who's lost somebody dear to them, a husband or child or whatever, we say they're doing well. What do we mean by that? And is our understanding of what how we're supposed to react and how we're supposed to treat each other based upon this idea that we're supposed to keep that so-called stiff upper lip? You remember the story of... I want to talk about the impact of the church. I do want to get to that because that's where I'm going. And is the church really a better place when everyone is doing this? That's kind of where I'm going with this. I'm not just talking about us individually and as individuals and having one-on-ones. I'm thinking, is the church really a better and a stronger church? And I'm all in here. I want this church to be as strong as possible. But I want to talk about that with that aim in mind. But with that, I got thinking about the story of Joseph, and most of you are familiar with him. Here's a man, a boy, who was tossed into a pit by his older brothers. We know that story. He was sold into slavery, eventually got to Egypt. Because of his acumen and his ability, he rose to a high place in Egypt, second in command. Eventually, his father and his brothers, get to Egypt. There's a famine where they are. They come to Egypt to buy grain. And Joseph recognizes them. They don't know who he is. They don't know what happened to him all this time. He recognizes them. And from Genesis 42 to 50, you read about all of this weeping on the part of Joseph. Even before he exposes who he is to them, he's just weeping over and over again. I think there's 10 times we see this powerful man who sitting in a high place just weeping, crying his eyes out because he's seeing his brothers. I think Genesis 45, 1 through 3, summarizes kind of his feeling. It says, then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, make everyone go out from me, he says. He's kind of like us. He says, I don't want everybody to see my emotions here. You made everybody leave. So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And think, what's going on? And Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Just complete, kind of lost it because of his joy. These are tears of joy in seeing his brothers. And of course, as I said, and as we all know, Jesus wept. He wept when he was going to take Lazarus out of the tomb. That's the context of John 11:35. I believe he wept because, some of you know this, I feel this way. I don't think he wept just because everybody else was weeping. I think he wept because he was going to have to bring Lazarus out of paradise. We would say heaven, going to bring him back from heaven because these people who he has tried to convince for 10 chapters in the book of John still don't believe. So you're going to have to bring him back out of there. And we're told in chapter 12 that after he brings him out, Lazarus, they're trying to kill Lazarus too, as well as Jesus. I mean, he brings him back to this dark world, out of perfect light, back to the dark world, just to get people to believe. It was his final sign that he does in the book of John. He also wept, though, when he came to Jerusalem. When he drew near to Jerusalem, saw the city, he wept over it. And these famous words in Matthew 23:37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. Jesus wept. He cried. I don't know how many times he did that. We're not told, I'm sure, all the times that he wept. I can just imagine. I can just imagine on those statements in the Gospels when Jesus went out to a desolate place and prayed. I imagine there was some weeping going on there. I imagine, we know in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was in agony. He was in agony because not just because of the physical thing he was going to undergo, but because of the spiritual trial he was going to go through and his dedication to saving us. I don't know how much he cried, but weeping is okay because Jesus did it. Now, I'm going to stop here and give you a disclaimer because this is what we have to do as preachers. And even in lessons like this, we're not necessarily talking about public crying and all that, right? And even though, you know, it was interesting in Joseph's case that he put everybody outside and then he cried and people heard him. That's fine. But it's not necessarily what I'm talking about this morning. And not too distant. Sometimes we need to kind of draw back on the prayer list. There was this young lady who used to always bring somebody up that was something like this. My co-worker's sister's aunt, second cousin, is sick and you need to pray for her. And of course, nobody knew her things, so we can get a little too wound up in some of those things. We got to be careful about oversharing. I think we all realize that. And too much information, too much detail. And certainly, we don't want to be whiners. And we don't get caught up in the victimhood thing. This Calvin cartoon, Calvin Hobbes cartoon says, This bad grade is lowering my self-esteem. And then the teacher said, then you should work harder so you don't get bad grades. And he sits there for a minute, and then he says, your denial of my victimhood is lowering my self-esteem. So, you know, there is that. We can't get so caught up in the victim thing that we're not very pleasing to be around. But back to my point is simply that expressing our feelings is okay. And expressing them honestly, I think, is healthy. I think it's healthy for the individual, and I think it's healthy for the church. So, I come to Job, and we all remember Job. He lost everything. He lost everything. He lost all his property. He lost his livestock, his livelihood. And then he lost his kids. I mean, sitting on 10 fresh graves. This is a hard book to explain, because we know that God allowed this to happen. He is in utter agony. And he loses his health. I mean, he's got nothing. He's scraping the boils that have dried up off his body with a piece of pottery. I mean, that's the state he's in. But when we look at Job and we look at chapters 1 and 2, we say, well, this is a very American Job in verses 1 and 2. Chapters 1 and 2. Because He's kind of fits the model, and he says famously in verse 21 of Job 1, he says, naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I will return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. If Job had a refrigerator, I'm sure he would put that right up on there, but I think his refrigerator was destroyed along with everything else. They had no refrigerator. He couldn't get a little magnet made, you know, put that up there, but this is what he said. This is what he felt. And then in chapter 2, when his wife says to him, can you imagine, verse 9, his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. And he makes another little statement that's really very American. Very, we all say, rah, rah. And we, by the way, we usually stop reading in Job 2, after Job 2. But anyway, he says, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God? And shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. That's chapter 1 and chapter 2. And as I said, we almost loathe to go past that because it gets real complicated when we get into chapter 3 and on. We know that his friends come to him and start talking to him. They first shut up. They don't say anything for a week. That's really good, right? We understand. They sit there. They're stunned at what he's going through. They just sit there and they're with him. No words. No words. The week goes by. And they decide it's time now to try to figure this all out. We're going to figure all this out. What's wrong with you, Job? We're going to start giving him advice. And we all know that we're not supposed to give advice until we're asked, right? That's not new to anybody in here. You don't just start throwing advice out to people unless they ask you. Nobody appreciates that. But that's what they do, because Job didn't ask them. They just start talking. They just start talking to them. And all of their arguments just fall on deaf ears. It's not making any sense. At the end of the book, we know that God jumps all over them for some of their dumb arguments he makes. One author said, Job finds that all those sweet, sugar-coated, simplistic, pious answers of his Bible-bearing fundamentalist friends melted before his searing questions. And that pretty well sums up the logic that they were bringing to this. Job, you must have sinned. You must have done something terrible to be in such a fix. He wasn't buying it. And they were wrong, as we know. But Job sat there, and he had some things to say for sure. And as we look at chapters 3 through 37, from 38 to 42, God speaks to him. But Job, in chapters 3 to 37, with his friends speaking to him and him responding to him, he makes his feelings known. He doesn't hold back anything. I'm sure he did a lot of crying, but there was more. He was just expressing himself. And it goes like this, verse after verse. I'm going to read very little of it right now. I had like 40 verses down there, but I think you can read the rest. You're just going to get started with this. You get the idea. Job chapter 3, 1 through 11. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Have you ever done that? I don't know, maybe some of you have. You're in good company if you did. He cursed the day. In other words, he said, why was I ever born? I would be better off if I was not born. Job said, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived, let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the numbers of the month. He didn't want anybody celebrating his birthday. Don't say happy birthday to me because that wasn't a happy day, says Job. This one, same one who said just a little bit ago, naked I came from my father's womb, naked I shall return. Lord gives, Lord takes away. He's kind of way past that refrigerator magnet wisdom. Verse 8, let those cursed who curse the day who are ready to rouse up the Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark, let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning. Because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? That's dark and dreary. That is about as dark as it can be. Just looking at verse 20, 26. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasure, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I'm not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. I think we get the idea, but we don't yet. Chapter 6, verse 8. Oh, that I might have my request, and that God would fulfill my hope, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. That would be my comfort. Okay, it goes on like that. Every time Job speaks, sometimes he's claiming his integrity, he's denying or arguing against the arguments made by his friends that he must have sinned somehow, and that's why he's in this predicament. And then other times it's this kind of thing. Loud complaining. Undoubtedly a lot of weeping. A lot of emotions that are raw, worn in the sleep. We can look at how David did this as well. David was one who wept bitterly on occasion. And David got himself into all kinds of trouble, but he was an emotional man as well. That's probably part of the reason he got in so much trouble. But he wept over his sin several times. He wept over his loss of the baby that he had by Bathsheba because of his sin. He wept over the Jonathan, when Jonathan dies, his good friend Jonathan dies. And then he weeps over Absalom. Absalom tried to take his kingdom from him. Absalom was the worst son a man could have in every respect. But when he dies, the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over his gate and wept. And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, Absalom, my son, I can't do justice to the emotion that probably came out of David at that time." But what we have here are examples of people who are expressing themselves, not holding themselves back. I don't think, in reading all this, and there's so much more, I don't see how one can validate the idea, not that anybody is, but validate the idea that we're to bottle up our emotions and that's where we're supposed to be. And we're all better off if we just kind of keep our feelings to ourselves. I don't think that's where God wants us. And maybe just looking at this from the most pragmatic view, perspective, most practical way we can, is this working? Does this work in society or in the church or anywhere in families? Aren't we seeing record levels of anxiety, depression, psychological problems these days? The suicide rate has gone up. And yet this is often where we find ourselves. Somebody says, I kind of want to cover everything here. So somebody says, well, what about self-control? Self-control. Let's talk about that a minute, because that's a good point. I don't believe self-control is the same thing as hiding our emotion. I don't believe that at all. That's not what self-control is. I have two passages up there. One, Proverbs 25:28, that talks about a city without walls is easily broken into. So self-control has to do, a man without self-control is like a city without walls, then that city can be broken into. So self-control first is the idea of there's protection, there's something, you are self-contained, you are autonomous, you are able to keep yourself under control. And certainly anyone who is outrageously complaining about things and yelling at people and outbursts of anger, that person doesn't have self-control. And an elder can't be that way. I mean, that's one of the qualifications of elder, and no Christian can be that way or should be that way. In 1 Corinthians 9, I like the image there, the analogy, because it's an analogy of an athlete. And I think the emphasis there, when he says in verse 25, 1 Corinthians 9, he says, every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. He's not talking about expressing ourselves there. He's talking about discipline and keeping ourselves out of trouble by controlling ourselves, just as an athlete disciplines himself so he can perform. And we get this. When we look at Jesus again and we look at his weeping, should be 35, turn to Hebrews chapter 5. I'm going to come back to Jesus. This text has always intrigued me, I'll put it that way. Always intrigued me. Hebrews 5:7. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. Loud cries and tears, Jesus expressed himself. He did not hold his feelings back. We can see times, of course, when he was angry as well. But he expressed himself. Who's a stronger, more resolute man who ever lived than Jesus? Who was a more self-disciplined man than Jesus was? No one, we would all agree. When we come back to Job for a minute, Job is passionate about his plight. He's passionate about where he finds himself in this mess. His feelings are raw, and he speaks out of that. He speaks out of that emotion, and he speaks honestly to God and to his friends. He doesn't hold anything back. And it goes on as on. I read just a very little of it, and you get the idea, and some of you have read the whole book. You know how those passions are expressed and how extreme they are in our culture. And yet, James 5 says he was a man, he praises him, says he was a man who had steadfastness. He was steadfast. Some versions say he was patient. He was patient. At the end of the book, when God gives him that big lecture, and that lecture doesn't address the questions that Job has directly, he simply says, "I'm God and you're not." That's basically what he says from chapter 38 to 42. "I'm God and you're not." That's the answer to your question. And Job repents of whatever faulty conclusions he'd come to. God never gets on to Job for expressing himself the way he did. He gets on to him for his faulty conclusions. Even his were faulty. His friends were really faulty. I mean, friends were out in left field, but his were faulty as well. But then there's this glowing postscript in Ezekiel chapter 14 that we read. And this is well, of course, after Job. Job, some say, before Abraham. He lived before Abraham. But this is what Ezekiel says, inspired by God. He says, "Even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver but their own lives by their righteousness, declares the Lord God." So the ultimate compliment is paid to Job. He's put into the company of Noah and Daniel. So, what is this all about? What's this "so what" here? What does this matter? We come back to this. How does this help us? How does maybe trying to, two things, trying to be a little bit more ready to express our true selves to one another, a little less of that hiding and trying to hide behind a mask of some kind, of that everything's great, how does that help us? And how does that help the church if we're doing that? How do we respond to people like that? Sometimes if you ask, you've heard me say this a lot because we say it every day. I mean, I've said it several times today. I said, "How are you doing?" What do you say? "Fine." What if you say, "How long, if somebody takes you aside, do you really want to know how I'm doing?" Anybody ever say that to you? "You really want to know how I'm doing? How much time do you have? Can you meet me for lunch tomorrow? Can we get together tomorrow night? You want to know how I'm doing?" That's not what we expect, and sometimes we kind of back off from that. What I'm trying to tell, what I'm gathering, and this is all to me, because I'm really good at hiding my feelings. I'm excellent at that. So I'm preaching to the preacher. But how will the church function if we quit imposing the stiff upper lip standard on ourselves and others? Kind of open up a little bit. I'm not saying, I gave you the disclaimers. I'm not saying you go that direction and go crazy with all that. But we open up with each other and be honest with each other and kind of take, I Googled this. I can't believe how many pictures there were of people who were like this, holding up a little mask that was smiley face on it. That's like your typical thing. You know, that's like, we're wearing this mask around. And I'd hate to think that we're here as brothers and sisters in Christ with that kind of attitude. That we're kind of just waiting. And that we're good with that. That we're just kind of have this fake smile. If members feel they can share their feelings, the church will function at peak efficiency if all the members feel they can share their feeling. Weep with those who weep. Rejoice with those, I think we got that right, right? Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. That's what Paul says we're supposed to do. The church will function at peak efficiency if we know what's happening in a person's life so we can carry out the commanding in Galatians 6:2, where we are to bear each other's burdens. How can I do that? How can I bear your burden? How can you bear my burden if you don't know what my burdens are? I'm not just talking about, we're commanded in James to confess our sins one to another. That's something too. But just talking honestly to each other and helping each other get through this life. Whether you've got kids and you want some help in raising kids and you're at the end of your rope with that, there are a whole lot of people here who have gone through that process who can help you. Don't say, yeah, my kids are great, you know, they're just wonderful, and then you get home and it's chaos. The people here who can help you with that. Don't be afraid to ask them, because the ball's in their court if you do that. You can ask Christy and I, because I'm up here preaching this, if everybody else, I mean, the ball would be in my court if you come to us. We put the emphasis on mercy and compassion, as James tells us to do in James 2, verse 13. So, I think we can be a more unified body if we adopt this to whatever degree we feel we can. Job said, is my strength the strength of stones or my flesh bronze? He said that in a time of deep distress and pain, physical pain. Can any of us say that? Are any of us this? Are we... we have the strength of stones and the flesh bronze. Sometimes we act like we do. But I don't think that's good for us or for the body. Well, this passage in Psalm 56, 8 says, you keep track of all my sorrows. You've collected all my tears in your bottle. You've recorded each one in your book. It's kind of sad if all those tears that God is collecting for us have all been done without help from anybody else. You may literally need to help somebody cry on your shoulder. Literally. Because there's nobody in here who has not shed some tears. That's all I have to say about that. Okay. I do want to say this, though, in connection with this, that he says you've recorded each one in your book. You know that book? This is we're going to sing this song in about 285, but you remember the book that we talk about back in Revelation 20, when he's going, when all the end comes, something's going to happen. Starts in verse 11. He says, "Then I saw a great white throne, and him who was seated on it. From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found for them." And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne. And books were opened. Books were opened. And another book, he says, was opened. Books, plural. And then a book was opened. One book. And he says, the dead were judged what was written in the books according to what he had done. This book, this one book, is the book of life. And he goes on to say, the sea gave up the dead and were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. What was written in the books. There's this book of life sitting over here. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, one book. Books with everything you've done in them. Which one do you want to be judged by? The books? Put that in our day, it would be like everything you did from the day you were accountable was on YouTube. And you get to sit there and watch it. All the stuff is on there. Or you erase all that. You don't go into the YouTube room. You go into where God is with his book. And he looks at the book and he says, your name is here. Welcome. Go to heaven. That's going to work. And just to kind of tie that in with what we're talking about, sounds like that maybe the tears are there along with your name. Just kind of an interesting thought. But the invitation is just, what book do you want to be in? What books? You want books or you want book? You want to be in the book of life or in the book that's cast into Hades? The books that are cast into Hades. We're going to offer you the opportunity to make that known. If there's something you need to do right now, you know what you need to do, then we give you an opportunity to step forward and make your wishes known as we stand.